The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 11 in the Book of Equanimity, the Record of Going Easy. The verse. The limitless tangle of all things allows for the extraordinary. Freely penetrating through and dropping hinders the eye. Who has the strength to sweep out this garden? What's hidden in a person's heart surely turns into feelings. A boat crossing the river sideways is soaked with the blue-green autumn. Oars enter the illuminated reed flowers, bright as snow. An old fisherman immediately takes a perch on the line to mark it. A single leaf flutters on a flowing wave. So this poem is by our Zen ancestor, Hongjer. He lived in the 12th century in China, one of the people in Dongshan's lineage who put together this collection that we call the Book of Serenity or the Book of Equanimity, and that our new translation calls the Record of Going Easy. He took 100 cases, 100 koan examples that touched him and gathered them together and wrote a poem for each one. We don't study these poems in our standard koan curriculum. They're quite beautiful and mysterious, in my opinion, and are worth looking at whenever we get a chance, especially if we've moved through this collection of koan. After he had gathered together the koans and written the verses, his student Wan Song wrote introductions to some of the cases, and actually to all of the cases, and commentaries. Sometimes his commentaries are on every line, and sometimes we read them too. Wan Song's Zen is so similar to our Zen. Hongjer's Zen is so similar. I wonder if you felt it during the chanting this morning when we read three of Hongjer's shorter pieces that we gathered together from a more current collection of his writings called It's about the empty field, cultivating the empty field, which was translated by a fellow we know, another great translator, Teigen Leighton. He's also known for other texts and other teachings, some of which we'll chant later today and tonight. But this poem, this translation of this poem, let's look into it as a way of understanding Hongjer's mind, a way of understanding Wan Song's heart and mind. How is it that this poem reflects the teachings of Yun Men that we've been looking at now for days? What is Hongjer trying to point out to us? And because it's a poem, every line carries not just intellectual meaning, of course, but some kind of heart understanding of what it means to be a human being practicing this great way. Even though 1,000 years have passed, it doesn't make any difference. The Dharma takes various shapes and forms as it moves through the centuries, through the various countries where it arises. It takes the form of Zen. It takes the form of many other spiritual and wisdom teachings. my heart happens to be in the Zen school, and for me it's enough, even though I love so many other wisdom texts and poetry. When I hear a Zen text, it breaks me open. Here in this hospital for broken hearts, this hotel for the broken open hearts, this is what we get to allow ourselves to sense our way into. When we use the word study in Zen, we don't mean the ordinary way that we all learned to study when we were in school, or some of us who have been teachers of various kinds, and that's a lot of people in this room right now, asked our students to study. There's another way of studying, which is to sink into this moment. And then when a teaching comes our way, we notice how the line of poetry, maybe, or the line of a koan, or the line of a text, or a teisho, resonates in our heart, mind, and body. And for just a little bit, we hang out there. We stay with that resonance as if we were struck by the sound of a distant temple bell, which penetrates every part of our being. The world can do this to us. This morning, when David and I were upstairs in the teacher's meeting room waiting for our first teacher's meeting of the day, waiting for me to go down to Kenton and greet the Sangha, we had the air conditioner on, and because it was a little muggy and close up there on the third floor. And then we turned it off, we opened the window, and we were met by, I don't know what they're called, but a bunch of crows just cawing, 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 cawing. And we stopped and listened, and I thought, what are they saying to us? What are they saying now? The birds in the distance, the sound of the rain, which began during our sutra service when we were chanting, reciting some of these texts by Hongzhi. What is the message? I always remember a really difficult time in my life, one of a zillion, but this particular one, which I won't talk about in detail, I was really struggling with my Zen practice and with my relationships in the Sangha and with my teacher. And I was sitting one day in a little zendo we'd carved out in a house that David and I used to live in. And then it started to rain. Pour rain. It was in the attic of the house, this little sitting space that we'd made with an altar and two seats. And I was sitting up there by myself, just lost in my pain. The sound of the rain was a wonderful distraction. It didn't even do anything to my mind. And I wrote a little haiku, probably the only haiku I've ever successfully managed to put together within the forms of haiku. It was, aching body, troubled mind, then suddenly the sound of the rain. This is what the world offers to us. If only we could put down some of the walls that have worked so well and have been so necessary to protect us through our difficult, challenging lives, just for a second, to let the sound of the rain and the cawing of the crows pierce us right through. We always, in those moments, shut down again and again and again, but then we get to practice what it's like to open. And the more we do it, it's like a door that's been stuck closed. I always like to say that Zen practice is like WD-40. It lets the door be ready to open. It dissolves all of the things that have been in our way, It doesn't open the door, but the practice allows us to decide to sit down on our cushions or chairs, to be present to our breath and body, and some other practices that we do in addition, always in addition to those basic practices. And then we can turn the door and open it and receive, receive, receive. The door will close again, but now that it's been WD-40'd, it won't get stuck anymore. We've been talking about being stuck, which is also part of the whole thing. And then we begin to realize that everything, everything that we consider as an obstacle, everything is part of the process of opening that door, opening to that, opening to our painful stories, opening to the physical pain in our bodies, opening to our emotional pain, receiving it, and also opening to the delusion that someday we will be able to transcend this personally, and then everything will be wonderful. But all of the things we wish to transcend, as Hongzhi says in one of the readings we did earlier, are part of what we discover. If you exclude them, then you're missing some important part of what it means to be human. So we exclude nothing. All of that pain and all of that suffering, these are the particular gifts that we get to work with in this lifetime. These are the scars. These are the colors of the stain of the glass. This is how it is. This is not a purification. The rain and the sound of the crows, they don't wash anything away, but they suddenly appear to teach us. Not that they have a consciousness like we do. It's because this is constantly happening. The world, as the Tibetans like to say, is kindly bent to ease us. In another koan where a student is very upset because he sees a bird of prey come down to eat an animal on the riverbank, and he says, why does this happen? And the teacher says, it's for your benefit. In other words, use everything. Don't exclude anything. It's all on the buffet. It's all on the snack table. So the first line of Hongzhi's verse is the limitless tangle of all things. And this is what I'm pointing to, the limitless tangle of all things. I love that translation of whatever this was in Chinese, tangle, because it does feel tangled. It feels so complicated. Even though Sesshin is a really radical simplification of daily life, it can get pretty complicated. And especially if you're new and you're learning all these ins and outs of when to bow and when to turn and how to hold your chopsticks and all this stuff, it can feel overwhelming. And then you get used to it and you kind of get it and there's an ease in it. And then we put you in leadership positions. The wonderful thing about this particular sesshin is everybody in the Sangha has a leadership position. So it's not just your practice you get to melt into, your simple practice of doing zazen, but the zazen of being the coffee master, the zazen of serving food to the Sangha, and all the extra parts of zazen, working in the garden and cleaning the bathrooms. And these are the activities of a bodhisattva. And getting in grumpy moods and utter despair and utter bliss, and all of it combined. Also, this is part of the limitless tangle, a tangle with no limits. If you think you're going to untangle your life, well, good luck. And he says, the limitless tangle of all things allows for the extraordinary. It's the extraordinary is not an exception to the limitless tangle of all things. It is part of the limitless tangle of all things. It allows, when we really turn our hearts to our lives, then the extraordinary, which apparently in the original Chinese, we do have some notes about this, meant the very highest mountain. Our practice of shikantaza, which in Japanese means just sitting, is very similar to a practice in Tibetan Buddhism called Dzogchen. And Dzogchen is often translated as the ultimate practice. Some Tibetan teachers say, this is the only one you have to do, just this. And I remember asking a Tibetan teacher that I took a retreat with, well, this seems a lot like Zen. And he laughed and said, oh yeah, it's exactly the same. We're just calling it by different names. But this opening to everything, this opening to everything, Dzogchen literally means the top of the mountain, the peak, where you get a view of everything, where in Tibet, I imagine, the mountains are pretty high, higher than our mountains here in the United States, higher than the mountains in Denmark. The wind blows freely through you. The sky is such a bright color in that place. The clouds form and fade away. The supreme ultimate is nice. The extraordinary is nice. But imagining being there, being here, sitting like a mountain, being a mountain, experiencing that freedom. Only through the activity of the limitless tangle of all things. And then he says, freely penetrating through and dropping, which is all hyphenated, it's one word, penetrating through and dropping, which is often how we talk about awakening experiences. Freely penetrating through and dropping hinders the eye. And that's Yunmen's main point. That's what he's helping us to see, that anything that happens to us that's already happened is not useful going forward into the present moment, into the next moment, into the next moment. And the wind and the rain and the sound of the birds are reminders of that. Don't cling, or if you're clinging, don't cling to your clinging. Just be awake to it. As Linji says, when it goes, don't run after it. And when it's not here, don't hold on. When it's here, don't hold on to it. This holding on and pursuing is the natural way of human beings. But there's something that's much more natural that we encounter in this extraordinary practice. The next line is, who has the strength to sweep out this garden? And this garden is a translation of a word that not only means a garden, but it means the meditation hall, the zendo. Sweeping out the garden, that's not what we're doing. Who has the strength for it anyway? Sweep and sweep all you want, another teacher says, you will never get rid of it all. This is not our activity, sweeping, cleaning, polishing a mirror. There's a time for those things. There's a time for working hard and really digging deep into the history of your life and all the different ways that we hold on to that historical suffering and getting insight into it and seeing it when it arises. But ultimately, we're not here to get rid of it. We're here to see that it too is the Buddha Dharma showing up in its problematic and sometimes amazing way. Wansong's comment on that line is, brushing away the traces leaves traces. I love that. Brushing away the traces leaves traces. The desire to be hidden is completely revealed. One of the things as an introvert who can be situationally extroverted is that I adore Sesshin because before I was a teacher and given leadership stuff, I could just lean back and think I was invisible. And I always remember my first teacher grabbing me. He was a very strong kind of teacher. Grabbing me as I was rushing late to the Zendo because, I don't know, I was coming back from the bathroom or something. And he said, "Do you think you're invisible?" I did. I'd lived my whole life up to that point counting on being invisible. I was not a public person. I was not someone who could talk to a group of people. Whenever I talked in public, my voice shook and I could barely get things out. It's not that Zen is a self-improvement program, as you know, but that behavior, I would say, based on this terrified fear of being seen, wore away in the face of something else. I love the Dharma so much, and when I was asked to share it and teach it, all I wanted to do was do that. I had to do other things too in my life. But, oh man, the fact that I'm sitting here right now talking to you, I can't believe my good luck. How extraordinary. How amazing that this practice that's saved my life, which has allowed me to see that everyone I encounter, everyone, even the problematic people out in the world who can be mean to me in the supermarket line, all those people are Buddhas. They just don't know they're Buddhas. And my only job is not to make them into Buddhas, because they're already Buddhas, but it's to meet them as Buddhas. And for you all who've decided that you really want to do this practice too, sometimes that takes the form of saying, "Hey, cut it out. Don't you see what you're missing? Look, look." And that arises in various ways. It can just be the way I feel when you come into the Doksan room and I bow to you. You might not even know it. Doesn't make any difference. But I will not give up, ever, because I love this practice so much and I want the world to experience it, and it won't, because who wants to do something like this? I mean, really? Sit for days and have your back and your hips and your knees and your ankles hurt, and I'm just talking about my body. Who would want to do this? Who would want to do this? You. You, listening to this talk right now, made some kind of decision. Maybe you'll never do it again. We had somebody once come to our 3-week coming and going Sesshin, who in the sharing at the end said he was over meditated. And we all laughed. And that was it. We never saw him again. He got what he needed and he left. We come and we go. Some of us keep coming. We know that this work of sweeping out never ends because there's nothing to be swept out, but we need the reminder again and again and again. I need the reminder. Everyone who practices this needs to be reminded. This is why we take refuge in the Buddha, in the historical Buddha, and in our awakened nature. This is why we take refuge in these teachings, the Dharma, the way things are, the real way things are, not the stuff we make up about the way things are. And in the Sangha. This is why we call them the three treasures, the three jewels. And when we begin to recognize this, then we can't stay away from this kind of training. Even when our life gets complicated and gets in our way, we find a way to come back. So then Hongjir says, "What's hidden in a person's heart surely turns into feelings. And I don't know what the word feelings was in Chinese, but I know that all the implications and all the commentaries on this line talk about feelings more like mind objects, that is, thoughts and emotions, part of the original Buddhist teachings about the four foundations of mindfulness, the third one being mind objects. We get to see them clearly. They turn into objects of perception, and we get to know them. Sometimes, as David's teacher George Bowman used to say, they make us cringe. A lot of sitting in Zazen is about cringing, because so much comes up and we think, oh, I can't believe when I was 18 I said that thing to that person. Oh, and you know, I can't believe when I was 69 I said that thing to that person. Hongjie says, what's hidden in a person's heart surely turns into feelings. A boat crossing the river sideways is soaked with the blue-green autumn. And here Hongjie does what he loves to do. If you read any of this poetry in the Book of Serenity, it's full of these lovely metaphors about the path of awakening, being on a boat on the river, going sideways, because there's nowhere to go. I love that word, going sideways. It's like all of this is lateral progress. We're already at the top of the mountain. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go but be fully present here and discover it, discover all its nooks and crannies, discover it for yourself. More and more, a lifetime of work never ends, never ends. And this boat that travels sideways with the blue-green autumn, it's soaked with the blue-green autumn. This is one of the metaphors we often use for Zen practice. It's not how much we grit our teeth and try to figure everything out. We get soaked with the practice, like walking in a light spring rain, or a light late summer rain, I should say. We don't even know we're getting wet. And then we come in and our clothes are wringing wet with the Dharma. Oars enter the illuminated reed flowers, bright as snow. Those flowers that we encounter when we go boating in New England, the white blossoms, white as snow, the oars dipping in. You can feel it. You can feel it. And Wangsan's comment on this, which I find interesting right now in this present moment, a lost person living on the riverbank, not yet ready to get in the water, not yet ready to get in the boat. This is how many of us are. We keep getting into the boat and out of the boat, lost, lost, lost on the bank. Coming into this practice is taking some kind of responsibility for our lives. Get in the boat and pick up those oars. We're going nowhere, we're going sideways, doesn't matter. And then the last two lines are, an old fisherman immediately takes a perch on the line to mark it. And this is one of the big turnarounds, as so many of these old Chinese poems do, at least these Zen poems. They take everything that's come before and they say, so, this is the setup, this is what I'm talking about, and now do it. So we're asked to be like that fisherman. He picks up a perch on his line and he doesn't just sit around and think, oh, how wonderful, this is so great, I've finally woken up, I have a perch, I'm going to have a great dinner tonight. He takes it to the marketplace. This is the work of a bodhisattva. Not to just sit around, but to enact our awakening so that everything and everyone we meet also tastes the deliciousness of the Dharma. He catches a perch and takes it to the market, freely giving, as many of the commentaries refer to the Oxfording pictures at this moment, where the final stage is returning to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. It's not, in the Oxfording pictures, having the experience of emptiness. That's way before the last Oxfording picture. It's important to have that dropping away experience. But as Yunmen is trying to tell us, as Hongjir and Wansang are trying to tell us, as the teachers are trying to tell us, this is not what we're aiming for. We're aiming for going out into the world, going to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. And the last line, a single leaf flutters on a flowing wave. A single leaf flutters on a flowing wave. Constantly in motion, the world keeps offering little bits and pieces to us. And if we're looking somewhere else, we'll miss it. Wansang's comment on this line is following the flow, realizing wonder. That is our activity as bodhisattvas, following the flow, realizing wonder. The limitless tangle of all things allows for the extraordinary, freely penetrating through and dropping, hinders the eye. Who has the strength to sweep out this garden? What's hidden in a person's heart surely turns into feelings. A boat crossing the river sideways is soaked with the blue-green autumn. Oars enter the illuminated reed flowers, bright as snow. An old fisherman immediately takes a perch on the line to market. A single leaf flutters on a flowing wave. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. Yep, and please make our half circle horseshoe shaped thing. Comments, observations, questions. Sabrina.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa. I think Jenny's comment last night about 42% has got me thinking about the end of Sesshin and what's going to happen after that. We'll have to go back to our lives. I am unemployed right now. I was laid off from a job that was very important to me about a little less than a year ago. And I have since struggled to find my way, find my purpose, find my meaning, what I'm gonna do next. So, 35 years old, and I'm just tired of going down dead ends. And Melissa, you said ultimate bliss, you said ultimate despair, and that's exactly what I'm feeling right now. Despair for having to go back to real life after this. But also complete bliss, because I am so thankful for everybody here for giving me the opportunity to feel purpose in serving and cleaning the bathrooms and meaning. It's just really wonderful. Thank you.
We're all crying up here. Yeah,
Sabrina, you speak the heart of us all, right? And to come forward and present this, how beautiful, how impossible. And we are so grateful to you. Just one more thing about this, just appreciating beginning, middle, and end, all happening at the same time, right? And we all know, you know, today is someday toward the end, 42, maybe 76. And real life is here, right? The conditions change. Not falling into classifications, not following conditions, Hongjir said. And to me, this is where faith comes in, that somehow what we're doing here changes us in ways we cannot grasp, cannot understand, but in our heart we feel it, don't we? Right? Don't know what's coming, but just clean the bathrooms, serve the food.
And, you know, I realize now that I was so absorbed. But now I think, now that we're in a new place, isn't that interesting, by the way? How, you said, you know, leaving here and going back to reality. What if this is the reality? And that stuff out there is the dream. And when we go out into the dream world, we have to be alert, because it's a dream. Anything could happen. Yeah. So it, there's opportunity at a certain point, they flow together. It's one reason we have so many sesshins, so many opportunities for practice every week. You know, what do we have, 11 or 12 practice groups that meet every week? It's to keep this reminder that there is a reality that's more substantial than the dream world out there with all the cars and the shopping and the jobs and all that. Thank you. Deb?
Thank you so much. I just wanted to share that something you said about the thousands of years of practice when I was washing rice today. It was like, you know how we say Buddhas through space and time? It was like, Tenzos through space and time, washing the rice. You know, it was just like, we've been washing the rice for...
Yeah.
And I just want to share that.
Wow. What's over there?
Yeah, these moments come to us. And I think the wonder of being part of this tradition and that service is such a huge part, this taking care of, and what it does for our hearts when we get to take care of something. And there's a whole world. We can take care of the floor. We can dig holes in the dirt. We can wash rice. And we are saved. We are nourished. We join in, right? And you, all the Tenzos, the whole universe are in the kitchen washing rice.
It really feels like the taking care is also taking care, you know.
Absolutely.
actually came up this morning, like that. Yeah. My childhood was, you know, not very loving, and but doing this work is loving, and I feel the love and I for myself and for everyone. So I want to share some bump in my being that comes up a lot, which is teaching yoga for a moment at a Zen retreat.
Is teaching yoga a Zen what?
At a Zen retreat.
Like,
this thing, okay. This issue's been with me, and my teacher, Marisa, has been with me for a long time, kind of dealing with this, which is I'm so oriented to healing people. And actually, yoga healed me, so that's what motivated me all the time to teach it. And I have experience in my being, and I hope other people is letting go. And Melissa has been saying to me for decades, no, it's letting be. Right?
Yeah.
And so doing this, and that has absorbed. I do understand that there's some big gift in really being with the ache that probably will never go away, right? I mean, some things do go away and shift, but there is a very deep truth about being the Buddha of our aches and pains, all of them. So it brings up a lot of stuff for me, even while I'm teaching, because my old impulse is always there. And from all the corrections from Melissa, my editor comes in and says, no, we've got to hold this. I just wanted to say that out loud. It's
great.
A funny predicament.
Mm-hmm. So, something I love about the way that you teach movement is that you keep inviting us to just feel what's going on in our bodies. And it's not, you know, if there's an ache, you know, lay it here and it'll be healed. It's like if there's an ache, just, you know, really let yourself know that there's an ache, and if there's a tight spot, really be with that tight spot. And to me, that's a really profound kind of teaching, which is how to relocate ourselves in our bodies, because we spend so much time pretending that we're disembodied. You know, and of course Zen practice reorients us to our body, but the yoga practice like supercharges that for a little period each day. That's how it's been for me, and so you don't need to be making it better. You are already making me aware, and in ways that I wasn't before we started the movement practice, and I really appreciate that.
And I just want to say that you're pointing to an inherent issue in any kind of teaching, healing, fixing modality. Because, you know, our car broke down last week, and the mechanic discovered that there was a rusty gasket, whatever it was, and he replaced it. You know, he fixed the car. This is a car that is 24 years old. So we keep doing that. The car is not going to make it for another 20 years, I don't think. Maybe it will. I don't know. We'll probably hang on to it as long as we can. We don't know if we're going to make it. But this often used to come up in teaching mindfulness. You know, I'm thinking of you and Carol are both trained MBSR teachers. And, of course, you're a doctor, Dave. And, you know, and my first job before I taught mindfulness, well, way before, I was a therapist too, which also it's implicit. Some of you might be therapists, right? Are all the things that we engage with in the world is that there are ways to heal a kind of misdirected body in the case of yoga, right? If you notice that somebody's holding their hip in a certain way, or holding their back in a certain way, just to notice that. Paul was my student at the MBSR clinic too, and a great teacher and a leader at the MBSR clinic. And so we all teach yoga. That's part of the thing. And Esther, gosh, we're just full of mindfulness people. But there's a kind of mindfulness that we call colloquially Mick mindfulness, like McDonald's, which is selling fixing. So you come into the clinic to fix yourself. And all the time, because of our roots in Zen, I think, we have to do something subtler. And I think I see that you're doing that with your yoga clearly, just like Alan pointed out specifically. To see the wholeness in people. Again, that's to see the Buddha nature. And then to see that this person needs a tumor cut out, right? You don't just go, let's be whole, let's embrace the tumor. Maybe you do, I don't know. If you do, it'd be interesting. But, just what's going on with this whole person here? Right? What's going on, the person with the weird hip or the funny back? If you just fix that, our old car. So we fixed that rusty thing, we replaced it with a brand new shiny thing. What's going to happen next? But the whole person has to do what I think Han Jura is pointing us to find our way to, oh, my knee hurts. And then to go on, right? Yeah. So you're not the only person with that bump, is what I'm saying. Anybody who teaches anything. And I'll just say one more quick thing about that. My first teaching job was, I was a piano teacher. And, it was fun with some people to just play all the black keys and fool around and go blah, 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 like what I do with my grandson. But at a certain point, you say, so this is C. And you put your thumb on it like this. And it makes this sound in a particular way. And it relates to this thing on this paper, It's both. It's both. Yeah. And sometimes, too, we lean more towards one than the other, just because the situation demands it. Thanks, Jenny. Yes, Jenny. There's Jenny.
So I'm going to the market. I usually like it when I'm Tenzo and I go to the market and then Willa Sesshin with my Sesshin eyes and see the people and the produce differently and there's good vibe and everything. It can be really overwhelming too, and I had one of these angry people yesterday and I can recognize. I can recognize a snarling wolf in a trap, but I'm like angry at myself for not like springing the trap, for just running away. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I don't know what my point is.
How did you know you didn't spring the trap?
Yeah. I don't, yeah.
Yeah. You're a bodhisattva power. He's limitless. And you can't always see it.
In fact, almost never.
Yeah.
That goes for all of us. And remember, I'm in love now with my new insight from Sabrina. That's the dream. I've had dreams like that.
Yeah.
Where people throw boxes in front of me on the counter. And I just, wow, what do you do in that kind of dream? You wake up.
Run.
Well, you could also run. You could also kill. You could do all kinds. So many options, but I don't recommend that. We should talk about the precepts sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa, for your talk. And lovely poem. I'm not familiar with it. And so... so many lines jumped out at me, but that last line about that single leaf. So
So where I live, a lot of trees, and it's known for its fall color, and always amazed by that. And I do take pictures from time to time. I do take pictures of you know, all the trees. But it's funny because occasionally my phone will tell me I've got too many, too much on it. I've got to delete things. And so, and I've got years of photos, you know, on this thing. And so I'll scroll through, and it's like, if I go through year after year, there's always a picture where there's a leaf that's on the ground, and I take a picture of it. Mm-hmm. It just... And I can never delete them either as I'm going through. There is something about it. It's like that one leaf,
yes.
You know, just shines mm-hmm. there. And, you know, on the ground and rocks, whatever, and there's that one leaf. And it's partly decomposed often at that point. And I just see that one leaf.
Yeah.
It reminds me of your talk when you said, you know, when Richard took you aside, mm-hmm. said you're not, said you're not visible. Mm-hmm. That leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I see that leaf.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am that leaf.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this, going back to Michael's comment to Jenny, this... you are not invisible, and the bodhisattva power of you, your wondrous bodhisattva power, beyond measure, and you cannot see that, you cannot know that, but yes, you are that leaf, I am that leaf. What we've longed to be, longed to make a difference, longed to heal the world, maybe in some way we have, we do.
And you know, I think about the, what kind of animal was it in the cage?
A wolf.
A wolf.
Not trapped,
yeah. Yeah. And also, who knows, she might be a bodhisattva too. Right? And can you receive her teaching?
Yeah.
We just don't know. So last, Esther.
So another animal will arrive. The battle-scarred tiger has been with me for the last couple of days and before I came. And so I see quite vividly this beautiful kind of a white tiger with scars, like running to the mountain, to the light, kind of. And at the same time, I remember when I was younger, I saw a horse once that had scars from racing through forests and like hitting branches. And just this beauty of both scarred and strong and light. And the part of your talk that touched me the most was where you spoke about, you know, touching the Dharma or meeting it, and just this... all you wanted to do was that, which really resonates with me. And then there is this life, and the bills, and the child, and the everything that we have to take care of. And, you know, in my daily life, what I'm most grateful for, and I feel it here too, is that this practice, not just being here on the cushion, but Zen, shows us something when we meet ourselves in this way, that we can see in others this light, you know, this bodhisattva nature. I see it, you know, every day when I work with other clinicians around patients and in every part of my life. It's like this wonder to me when that arises in me, that there's something available that I sense or see that I'm absolutely convinced comes from this practice. And it's about that field of light that everyone comes from. So no matter what kind of judgments or this and that happens, there's always that light too. And so helpful when I look at myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I'm making any sense. But
oh yeah, very much so, very much so. And you know, it's it's a little different for me in that I think I saw that light all my life, but I was really confused by it. Because if I saw it in, you know, the caged wolf, and they snarled at me, I thought, it's like so confusing, you know? And Zen gave me a shape for understanding what's happening when it's not a misread, right? I do see the light. And sometimes it has, what does St. Teresa calls it? Jesus has sometimes a distressing disguise. Still Jesus, though.
I think I was the same way.
I think you were too, but I didn't want to assume.
But that also, you know, at one point I didn't quite, maybe it was around the Battlescar tiger,
yeah.
You know, that there also comes a point where this tiger ended all the battling in a way. I don't know why, I just...
Yeah?
You know, and yeah. Because meeting that both the light and the fear and interaction with other people kind of developed a tiger that would battle.
Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that point of confusion leads to all kinds of self-protective habits. And so that's another thing that we're unraveling on the cushion, really. Including it rather than trying to purify and cut it out. Yeah, it's wonderful. Battle-scarred tiger with shanks gone gray.
That's the horse.
Oh, that was the horse.
I was thinking about the battle-scarred tiger, too, when I gave the talk and talked about the scar. You know, if you think there's no scar, you're in trouble. And as you were talking, I was thinking how you'll never see a tiger putting vitamin E on its scars. You know, it's just, it's not ashamed of them. And the scars are just signs that it's kept going. And you know, the last few days we've been showing each other our scars. And so I'm not surprised that came up for you too. And I think, you know, I just really feel honored that we feel safe here to show the scars like Paul did last night, but I could name so many people. And we're not here to be healed, and yet it makes it way easier to live with those scars if we can open our hearts to each other and show them in a way that our practice really fosters.
Well, and as I think many of us know, the origin of the word heal in English is the Anglo-Saxon for whole. Mm-hmm. So that is what we are engaged with, becoming whole. Keep that tiger around. Thank you, everybody.